All right. Thank you very much, Michelle. Welcome to everyone around the country. We had our official start to summer last week. So I hope that accompanying appropriate weather is in your area. Summer is here and the time is right for racing in the street. So we have an excellent session and excellent speaker with us here today. As a reminder, the ADA Audio Conference Series is a program of the ADA National Network. It is the longest running educational program of the network. The network is funded by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Administration on Community Living, National Institute on Disability Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. You can locate the regional ADA center that serves your state by visiting ADATA.org or by calling the toll-free number that will direct your call to your regional center. That is 800-949-4232. So welcome again, everyone, to today's ADA Audio Conference session. For those of you that are participating in the webinar platform, you can submit questions throughout the session. You can submit those questions in the chat area. While you will not be able to see those, we will, on our end, be able to see those questions. So if you have a question, submit it as we go along. For those of you that have connected by telephone, when we get to the portion of the session where we do the question and answer, we will bring our operator back to give instructions on how our phone participants can ask questions. The materials were made available in advance, so those materials are available for download through your account. All right, effective communication, what does that mean? Joining us today, we have Shannon Moutinho, who is a recent graduate of the University of Illinois Chicago here in Masters of Science. We are pleased to have Shannon. Shannon is also an independent sign language interpreter in the Chicagoland area. She also works at a call center for a video relay services agency in the Chicago area, and is just an all-around great person. I got to make sure I tick off all the check marks. So Shannon gives me the $5 she promised me for saying nice things about her. So that's enough from me. And as I said, following Shannon's presentation, you'll have an opportunity to ask her lots of good questions. So welcome everyone, and I want to welcome our speaker today, Shannon. Shannon, it's all yours.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you for all the kind words. I guess I do owe you $5 after this. Thank you, everybody, for being here today and joining us for this session. As Peter said, I just advanced to the next slide. I am a sign language interpreter. I have been for more than 10 years at this point in the Chicagoland area. I also just finished my Master's of Science in Disability Studies from University of Illinois at Chicago. There's a picture of me on this slide on the right. On the left, we have the agenda. I'll give a quick rundown of the orientation of laws that cover effective communication. We'll go through deaf populations. There's various, deaf people are individuals just like everyone else. And with individuals becomes individual needs. What works for one person as effective communication may not work for another person. So I always think that it is helpful to know basics about who you're dealing with, about various deaf populations, and what typically works for these populations. We'll go over a few of the accommodations options that are out there. This is not an exhaustive list. This is just most of the common ones and which to use particularly in which kind of setting with which kind of deaf people. We'll look at some examples of effective communication in practice with these accommodations. And of course, then we'll do a conclusion. I'm not going to cover the laws extensively in this session. If you are interested in learning more about the laws and their requirements for effective communication, please look at our other webinars on the subject in the archive. I do want to give a quick rundown just so people are somewhat familiar of the various settings that we see these accommodations most commonly provided. So we have the Americans with Disabilities Act. Titles, this should be Titles 1, 2, and 3. Titles, well, I'll go through that on the next slide. The Rehabilitation Act, most commonly Section 504. And then the Affordable Care Act, Section 1557, which is the civil rights section of that law. Next slide, slide 12. So I think the most common question that I get when people really start looking at effective communication is, what does that actually mean? When do you know that communication has been effective? And the way that I have understood this, the only way to really guarantee for yourself to know if your communication with people with disabilities, with deaf people, has been effective is when the patient understands the information. And how will you know that the patient, or the client, I should say, how do you know that you have achieved effective communication, is if you ask that person to repeat back to you what they have understood. Now, this is not always going to be possible. It's very easy to do this in a medical setting, for example, but it is not as easy to do it, let's say, if you provide accommodations for a live theater production. You're not going to be able to ask your clients to repeat back to you everything they understood. But the point is, you should be checking in with your clients, with the deaf people that you are working with. Check in with them and see how it's going. Do they feel comfortable with these accommodations? Are they able to access the information? Going on to the next slide. The Americans with Disabilities Act titles, it should be Title 1, 2, and 3. I apologize, Title 1 is not on there. Title 1 covers employment. So if you are employing deaf people in your place of business, Titles 2 covers state and local government services. So this includes things like the state court systems, state law enforcement, any state services, social services, that kind of thing. And then Title 3 covers private businesses, nonprofit organizations that serve the public. So places of public accommodation, we're looking at private doctor's offices, but then also theaters, places of entertainment, that kind of thing. So the Americans with Disabilities Act prohibits discrimination of people with disabilities in employment, state and local government services, public accommodations, transportation, and telecommunications. The Rehab Act, Section 504, forbids public and private entities that receive financial assistance from any federal department or agency, which includes Medicaid, Medicare, and the Affordable Care Act insurance, so insurance bought on the marketplace, from excluding qualified individuals with disabilities or denying them an equal opportunity to receive program benefits and services. So any federal entity, so here it's the federal court system, any federal agency providing services. And then we have the Affordable Care Act. So this was put in place to close the gap on any medical providers who were, let's say they were a private medical provider that was only open to people with private health insurance. So they are not accepting patients with Medicaid, Medicare, or insurance bought on the marketplace. Therefore, they're not accepting any federal dollars, but they are operating as a medical provider. The Affordable Care Act says if you are operating as a medical provider at all, you are required to provide accommodations to people with disabilities, which includes in Section 1557, is the civil rights provision of the Affordable Care Act, and it requires if you have deaf patients, you must provide effective communication, accommodations for effective communication. Next slide. Primary consideration. You'll find this in the ACA as well as in Title II of the ADA. Primary consideration is when public entities, private entities, are encouraged to honor the choice of the individual with a disability, the choice of accommodation. The individual with a disability is in the best position to determine what type of aid or service will be effective. Now, this seems like it should be common knowledge, of course, the deaf person will be the best to suggest which accommodation they need, if, you know, if captions are going to work best for them in this instance, or if a sign language interpreter is what they need. But you'd be surprised how many assumptions are made that, you know, everyone can read. Therefore, captions might be effective, but we know that not everybody can read. Or maybe the assumption is, oh, they're deaf, let's get them sign language. But not everybody uses sign language. I have actually, as an interpreter in my professional life, I have shown up to jobs that I was booked for by a doctor's office or a corporate office, where I show up and there's the deaf person there, and they look at me and say, I don't need you, I don't know sign language. And the doctor's office or whoever is the provider had to go back to square one. And this was all because they did not talk to their client or their patient before the event happened. They didn't even bother to check in with them and say, hey, what accommodation works best for you? Now, primary consideration is specified in there, obviously, because of what we just talked about. Let's say the deaf person says, I want a sign language interpreter. I do not want captions. I do not want video remote interpreting, which is, we'll talk about that later. I want a live in-person sign language interpreter. But maybe the location where you live, there is not a qualified interpreter anywhere in the vicinity. Maybe there's not one available. We would like to see that the provider has at least done their homework, found out that the preferred accommodation is not available. They can prove that they actually did look and went with a secondary choice. I think a lot of people have felt in the past that they ask for one accommodation or the other, and the provider doesn't honor that request. They don't even try. They don't even look, and they just jump to whichever one is most convenient for them. And convenience does not always achieve effective communication. I'm going to skip ahead. I'm going to skip the next slide. So now we're on surcharges, slide 18. Surcharges, basically, with all the laws, under all the laws, the Rehab Act, the ADA, and the ACA, you are not allowed to charge the deaf person for those services. There are, unless you are exempted from the law, which is only private clubs, if you are a Native American reservation or religious entity, then you may or may not qualify for an exemption. But if you are covered under the law and accommodations are required, you are not allowed to charge the deaf person for those services. Next slide. Okay. So now we're getting into deaf populations, and I'll spend a good amount of time here. You'll see on the right, there's a picture of two boxes of crayons. The box of crayon on the left looks kind of vintage, old-fashioned, and the labels on the crayons say things like hearing impaired, deaf and dumb, lip reader, dummy, handicapped. These are old and outdated labels that we do not use any longer. Deaf mute, deaf dumb are old labels, outdated. They're considered offensive. They're also misnomers, because deaf people are not necessarily mute. In fact, most of them are not. Most deaf people choose not to use their voice, though, because most hearing people cannot understand the vocalizations that they do have. Anyway, if you are working with deaf populations, the correct terms are deaf and hard of hearing. So you'll see that box of crayons on the right looks like a modern box of crayons that have labels deaf, signer, hard of hearing, deaf American, late deafened, deaf blind, seeing, and CODA. We will cover some of these in the next few slides. Credit to this artwork goes to Ann Silver, who's a great deaf artist. So deaf populations, we have deaf with a lowercase d, and that is on purpose, it's not a typo, hard of hearing, deaf with a capital D, deaf blind, or deaf and low vision, deaf disabled, and deaf ASL, SL, ESL, which is deaf people who use ASL as a second language, and English is also a second language. So for some people, it may be a third or fourth language. First, we have deaf with a lowercase d. Generally, these are deaf people who do not use sign language. They do not identify as culturally deaf. So on the right, you'll see the capital D deaf. That refers to people who use sign language. They also identify with a community and a culture of deaf people. Little d deaf people do not necessarily culturally identify with that same group. These deaf people are often raised with an oral method, which means that they were raised being taught to lip read and speak. That is often problematic, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. They may be late deafened. So late deafened people, you know, as people who become deaf with age, usually senior citizens, and if you've, you know, spent 65 years of your life hearing and speaking, most people are not going to drop everything and start learning sign language at 65. So elderly people, or senior citizens, we know them to be deaf or hard of hearing, but not part of the deaf community. And then little d deaf people also might identify as hearing impaired. Now, I just got through saying we don't use those terms anymore. But some people might refer to themselves as hearing impaired, but generally that's going to clue you into maybe what style of communication they often prefer. Again, don't jump to conclusions, but these are cultural nuances that as you work with these populations, you might pick up the clues. Next we have hard of hearing in the middle. Hard of hearing people, and this is generally written with capital H's, hard of capital H hearing, have some hearing. That hearing might only be possible with an assistive device, such as a hearing aid, a cochlear implant, an FM system, and what have you. These people might prefer captions to sign language interpreters, but they do often use sign language themselves. So they might be a little flexible in which accommodation that they prefer, depending on who they're with and what the occasion is. Hard of hearing people often identify as culturally deaf, culturally hard of hearing, as they regularly identify as being part of the deaf community and deaf culture. A little fun fact, or ironic, I guess, understanding is that hearing people, generally when hearing people talk about others as hard of hearing, we consider their hearing to be to have a significant hearing loss, right? When grandpa's hard of hearing, you've got to speak up because he doesn't hear very well. But if you're coming from the deaf community, when they say that one of their community members is hard of hearing, they usually say that to mean that their hearing is quite good. So it really depends on what perspective that you're speaking from. But that's just another cultural nuance that as you work with these populations, the misunderstandings of what people mean, it is possible depending on if you are fluent in the culture or not. All right, now we have capital D deaf, and there's a little icon of the two hands. This design, this logo right here, was actually originally designed by Ann Silver, the same artist that we saw do the box of crayons. It has been co-opted by the deaf community, by the interpreting community, and has become kind of a universal symbol for sign language, for sign language interpreting. So this is just a note to anyone who might offer various languages at your place of business, at your office. If you have one of those signs that has flags to denote every language service that you offer, you might want to use this logo with the two hands. People who need sign language interpreters will recognize that as as a marker for ASL, for offering American Sign Language. So capital D deaf people, their primary and preferred mode of communication is usually sign language. That doesn't mean that they will never request captions or English, but their primary and preferred mode is usually sign language interpreting or sign language. They're a visually oriented group, and we'll talk about this more, why this is important, but they are a visually oriented population that really depends on visual aid, visual sight lines. Everything around that is important to think about when you are working with these populations. They identify as culturally deaf and a linguistic minority. So a lot of deaf people, you'll hear them say, well, I'm not disabled, I'm deaf, and I'm a linguistic minority in the United States. So they really don't identify with being disabled so much as we are a people that uses a different language, just as you have other linguistic minorities in this country, Polish, Spanish, etc. You have sign language users. And then another cultural note I have in here is straightforward communication. Capital D deaf people they are dealing with a legacy of miscommunication because they don't use a language that is understood by the mainstream, because there's just kind of this legacy out there of poor education, lack of services, lack of access to language, even at home. Most deaf people are born to hearing parents, and the statistics of how many hearing parents learn sign language to talk to their kids is quite poor. And so even at home, they're often misunderstood. There's often lots of miscommunication happening. And so culturally, it has developed that the style of communication within the deaf community is very straightforward. There's no sugarcoating. There is no kind of niceties. And granted, I'm talking in sweeping generalizations here, but culturally, in hearing culture, it might be considered rude to say things like, oh, I haven't seen you in a while, you've gotten fat. But in the deaf community, they're stating the facts. This is what they see. And it's not considered rude. It is a style of communication, straightforward communication. But when this really matters with working with deaf populations, for example, an employer might have a meeting with a hearing employer, might have a meeting with a deaf employee and say something to the effect of, if you are late again, we will have to reevaluate your position here at the company. In the hearing world, we might understand that to mean, if you don't straighten out your attendance, you might be fired. In the deaf world, a sentence like, we'll have to reevaluate your position here, it won't be communicated the same in ASL. They would go straight for the direct meaning of that message. If you're late again, you will be fired. If you're late again, there'll be some kind of action taken. So keep that in mind when you are talking to people who identify with the deaf community. If there is something sensitive that you need to discuss with them, think about the ways that you're trying to communicate with them and what is going to be the clearest route to take. Okay. Deafblind populations. So this is also, again, not a typo. Deaf and then no space, capital B, blind. The deafblind community also identifies as a community. They sometimes will identify as a subgroup within the deaf community. Sometimes they identify as completely independent community, separate from the deaf community. There are still some cultural deaf tendencies there, but the deaf-blind community, remember the deaf community is a visually oriented people, but if you are blind or have low vision, you're not going to be visually oriented. Deaf-blind community usually identifies as a tactile community, so everything revolves around touch. Tactile interpreting, kind of a crude visualization of that is if you think of the most famous scene of any Helen Keller story where Anne Sullivan, her teacher, signs water into her hand. That is tactile interpreting, where an interpreter is signing and a deafblind person's hand is on top of the interpreter's hand. Sometimes instead of the deafblind person's hand on right on top of the interpreter's hand, you'll have them do what is called tracking. The deafblind person's hand actually just stays on the forearm of the interpreter and helps them to track where the hands are moving to. So maybe these deafblind people have a little bit of vision, but they need to track where the hands are going so that they can direct that little bit of vision that they have to where the interpreting is happening. And of course, deafblind people are going to be the best ones to tell you what exactly they need. There are interpreters who do this kind of work. There are also sign language interpreters who prefer not to do this kind of work, or they haven't had proper training in this kind of work. So that's another thing to think about when you are thinking toward getting accommodations for deafblind people. There's also pro-tactile interpreting, and this has been around for a while, although it's been a slow learning curve for the interpreting community to be trained in this, as well as sometimes the deafblind community to have access to this as well, to have access to training on it themselves. Pro-tactile interpreting it's like tactile interpreting 2.0. Instead of just having the deafblind person's hand on top of the interpreter's hand, the sign language interpreter will use both hands but do more sign language on the arms or perhaps sometimes even the body of the deafblind person. A lot of times you'll see multiple interpreters interpreting for one deafblind person at the same time. So one person might be the primary interpreter giving the language, giving the actual sign language. Another interpreter is behind the deafblind person, giving them environmental cues on their back and shoulders. So they can do signals on the back and shoulders to say, somebody's just entered a room. Now people are laughing, people are smiling, people are sleeping, people are leaving the room, etc. You might even see a third interpreter giving the deafblind person feedback on whether the hearing people are nodding, if they are still listening. And so I'll have a picture later where we can see this in use. Deafblind people might use Braille. They might not, depending on their tech savviness. They might use electronic communication better than they use Braille. So just check in again with your individual, see what is best for them. Might need to think about environmental adjustments when you're working with deafblind people. Sometimes light and lighting is very sensitive with deafblind people. If something is real bright, like if you have a window as a source of natural light, it might obscure the vision that deafblind people do have. So making sure that the environment is, effective for them. Also, it helps sometimes if people wear dark colors instead of a white shirt. A white shirt or light-colored neon colors might be a problem for some deafblind people. So just check in with them again. Also, deafblind people sometimes bring or request or use a support service provider. This is abbreviated SSP. Support service providers are not interpreters. Sometimes they do know sign language, but it's a little bit of a different job and responsibility. SSPs are people who might lead the deafblind person around a physical environment. They might lead them to the bathroom. They provide services outside of the interpreting requirements. I think that, and if anyone wants to correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that Seattle is the only place currently that has included support service providers in their laws as a accommodation required for deafblind people, that so far, support service providers are not recognized in the same ways that sign language interpreters are. Seattle is way ahead of the game in their deafblind services and supports. I think we could all take a lesson from them. But anyway, support service provider, SSPs, some interpreters will also provide this service, but you really do have to check in because it's kind of an individual basis whether the person has the right training. And whether the deafblind person wants that or not, they may not want an SSP at all. Deaf disabled. So this is deaf people who might also have a physical disability or an intellectual disability. Sometimes we see deaf disabled as a result of language deprivation. So there is recent work on this within the last 10 years. There's a lot of studies that's going on regarding deaf people who are not given access to language in the first 10 years of life and how this sets up barriers for them in the long term. It might be cognitive barriers, it might be something else, linguistic barriers, but it unfortunately happens more often than you think, and not just in this country, it happens worldwide. Let's see, deaf disabled people, they might work with an advocate or social worker. A lot of times in a doctor's office, you might see a group home or a social worker accompany a deaf person to the appointment. This is not always the case. The interpreter is usually not a social worker or an advocate. The interpreter is usually hired separate of that situation. So just be sensitive to that. Don't assume that an interpreter is an advocate for this deaf person or a social worker. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. Deaf people who are also disabled are sometimes isolated from common knowledge. So if you think about living in a hearing world, hearing people get up in the morning, turn on the radio, get the news from the radio while they're doing other things. They talk to their family, get updates from their family. They go to school. They listen to the radio in the car. They overhear language or overhear conversations in the classroom, in the office, in the doctor's office, and are just constantly getting the newest information, what's going on in the news, what are medical advancements and updates. And deaf people are not always, they don't always have access to this in the same way. When you're deaf and disabled, if you are living in a group home, for example, you might have further barriers to that. Sometimes deaf people are living in a group home with no other person in the group home who knows sign language. So they're really kind of isolated from this flow of communication and common knowledge. And if you're working with deaf people who are disabled, you're going to want to think about that and keep in mind that what you think is common knowledge, what you think is common sense, is not not a privilege for deaf people who are isolated or have other barriers. All right. Deaf users of ASL as a second language and English as a second language, usually we see these as deaf immigrants coming to this country. You might see them in the immigration office or in educational situations or doctor's offices. I mean, anywhere, everywhere else. Sometimes they do not use or they do not yet know ASL depending on their experience here in America. Sign language is not universal. American Sign Language is used in America, some parts of Canada, some parts of Mexico, and Ghana in Africa. I've been told in the Philippines, but I've had other people tell me that's not true. It's also used in Belize. But if you as an American wanted to go to England, for example, if you're hearing, we can communicate with them, right, because they speak English, but their sign language is completely different. Completely different alphabet, different grammar structure, different signs. It's impossible to translate between the two. Well, you can translate between the two, but it's impossible to compare the two. They're completely different languages. So that goes for almost every other country around the world, Kenyan Sign Language, Chinese Sign Language, Japanese Sign Language. They're all very different. So when deaf people are coming to America, they do not yet know ASL. They might also not have any English experience. And so to think about that in working with them, in these situations, using a deaf interpreter, and I'll define that in a minute, using a deaf interpreter is strongly encouraged. Things to keep in mind, illiteracy. In the deaf community, because access to education is not always what it should be, deaf people don't always read and write at a privileged level, I guess. Even those who have gone to college might still struggle with reading and writing. I think the statistic is that a deaf person who has graduated high school might still read at a fourth grade level. Now, of course, this is a sweeping generalization. This is not going to be everyone you meet. But if you ask a deaf person, can I give this to you in writing, or here's some instructions, or can you read this form and sign it, if they say anything to the effect of, I'm not so great with English, I'm not so good at reading and writing, what they're really meaning a lot of the time is they're completely illiterate. And I struggle to say that because they might be able to answer very simple questions like, what is your name, what is your birth date? But if you are handing them a consent form for a procedure or a surgery, or if you're handing them a mortgage contract for a home or anything else, that is some pretty complicated text that hearing people might even have trouble with, but then being deaf, there's further barriers. So thinking about that, and then especially with that sentence of, I'm not so great with English, in my experience, that has been code for, I really don't read very well. So then you think about, how would you conduct business with any person, not just deaf, but any person who is illiterate? Think about applying those techniques here. Limited peripheral learning. So we just talked about that a little bit, especially with deaf people who are disabled. But again, that flow of common knowledge or news updates that's constantly accessible in the hearing world is not to a deaf person. So information that seems commonplace to you is not always going to be commonplace for a deaf person. If you can take the time to make that direct communication with a deaf person, you're going to be a lot better off. And then family networks. This is pretty understood nowadays, I feel like. But even maybe 20 years ago, when hospitals or whatever facility were more stringent about how you're related to this person, whether or not you have access to be with them, in the deaf community, because of the language barriers, even within family, blood relations, family networks and family structures in the deaf community are often compiled of lots of friends from the deaf community who are not necessarily blood relations, just to keep that in mind. All right. So accommodations for effective communication. Not sure if... Nope. Okay. Sorry, I advanced one screen ahead. So looks like my animations here are not going to work. But accommodations for effective communication, it depends. And the images that you're not going to be able to see here because there was an animation behind it, if you are needing accommodations for a doctor's office, it's going to look very different than if you're trying to provide effective communication for theater or if you're trying to provide effective communication at a sports game. And we'll get into some of these following. But before we do, I do want to stress that lip reading and the assumption that deaf people can lip read is a myth. So here I have on the left that lip reading is an effective mode of communication for most, if not all, deaf people. And the fact of the matter is that the average rate of accuracy for lip reading is 12.4%. So out of everything that you're saying, deaf people are catching maybe every eighth word. anything beyond 30% is an outlier. I have met one deaf person in my whole life who can lip read almost perfectly, but of course it also depends on, and I have these bullet points here, that this deaf person also is knowledgeable about the context of the subject, usually has some residual hearing, is participating in a setting one-on-one with somebody. They're not sitting at a conference table where a conversation is quickly bouncing between various people at the same time. They are speaking one-on-one, facing somebody else. That the communication is happening with eye contact. It's one thing to sit across from somebody and try and lip read them. It's another thing to try and lip read someone while they're turning around and facing the whiteboard and writing something and then turning back to you and then talking to their into their computer and et cetera, et cetera. Clean shaven face, those men with giant beards, sometimes lips and mouths are hard to see. When people speak with accents, the shape of their mouths is non-standard, which also affects the ability for people to lip read, standard mouth shape and speech production. Sometimes even if people's teeth are not straight, this can affect the shape of the mouth, and so trying to lip read that can be quite dubious. And then it also requires an excruciating amount of patience, because if somebody doesn't understand, then they might ask you to repeat yourself and clarify in other ways, and it can take quite a long time. So the point of this slide, if you remember nothing else today, is that lip reading is a problematic expectation of how to communicate with most deaf people. All right. So as you think about working with these populations and providing accommodations for effective communication, you want to think about who and what is going on, who and what is involved, how often, and how soon do you need this to happen. So who and what, who is requesting, who is that deaf person, do you know anything about them, do you know their style of communication, do they have preferences, are they flexible in their preferences depending on the situation, are there multiple deaf people within one event, get to know your clients. What are they requesting? Do they have a preference? Did they request a sign language interpreter? Did they request captions? Did they request something else? For what kind of an event? Obviously, that's pretty straightforward, but are you meeting with this deaf person at a corporate office? Are you employing them? Are they a medical patient? Are they coming to your entertainment event, et cetera? Is the situation going to be gender specific? So if you're hiring, for example, if you're hiring a sign language interpreter and it is for, who knows, an appointment at an office, like a Social Security office, it's not going to matter so much versus if you have a deaf woman going for a mammogram or an OBGYN appointment, she might want to specify she only wants a female interpreter, and of course with men, if they're going for a physical, they might require a male interpreter. Can services be remote? So we'll talk about this when I give examples of what kind of accommodations are out there. Sometimes you can get a captioner, like we have today, who is remote. So the captioner is not in the very same office as I am, but as long as they are able to hear me, they are able to do their job as effectively as if they were sitting in the office with me. And this makes it easier in some instances, especially when there might not be a captioner anywhere in my town, but I still need those services, and they can be remotely plugged in to whatever event that's going on. All right, so how often is the event ongoing? So is this a classroom situation? Maybe you work at a college and you need a sign language interpreter for this class on Thursday night for an entire semester. This is really key in providing the best, most effective accommodations or effective communication possible. If you think of a classroom situation, and you book one sign language interpreter or one captioner for the entire semester, that person is going to be able to learn along with the student and provide an accommodation or a product that is consistent with the information. They have a good rapport with the student. They can they agree on signs or abbreviations of things that they know for their purpose within this class, signals this concept or that concept. Versus if you have a class that meets once a week, but you don't hire an ongoing interpreter, and it's just kind of ad hoc piecemeal whoever's available, and every week there's a new interpreter, and that interpreter doesn't have any background knowledge or context of what has been going on in this class, it's actually going to be quite difficult for them to provide as good an accommodation as if with the interpreter who is going the whole way through. So if you have an interpreter or a captioner who is a new one every week, it's not going to be as good as if you can employ one for the entire semester. So sometimes you can actually be strategic in, is the event ongoing and how often are you using the service? Would it actually make more sense for you to figure out how to get someone on staff depending on how often you're using the services? So here in Chicago, there is a hospital who actually does have on-staff interpreters because the deaf community knows that this hospital provides these services, and they actually rally together and they will all use this one hospital, which meant there was more deaf patients going to the hospital to the point where the hospital said, actually, this makes more sense if we just have someone on staff. It makes more sense from a consumer perspective of providing the best services. It also makes more financial sense sometimes. So it just depends on your business model, on what you're trying to achieve, how often, and again, how many consumers are requesting the same service. If it's just one person once in a while, then obviously it's going to be on an as-needed basis. But maybe it's more than that. Maybe it's seasonal, and you can develop a relationship with the same service provider, with the same accommodation service provider ongoing, so that you don't need to hire them on as staff, but you know who to go to every time you get a sense of what works, who the qualified people are out there. And then how soon? Is this an emergency? Are you working in an emergency room and you need to make sure that you have a strategy in place to be able to request accommodations as soon as possible at the drop of a hat? So even if the deaf person comes in at 1 in the morning, do you have a strategy in place? It's unfortunate that it happens all too often where an emergency room, for example, does not have a strategy in place. And when the deaf person comes in with an emergency, they're already stressed out, of course, because they're not feeling well. And in addition to that, now they have to deal with an emergency room with employees who don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to request an interpreter. They've never gotten this before. They don't know who to call, which only adds to the stress of the situation. If you do have a requesting policy, so let's say you're not an emergency room. Maybe you operate a theater and you have or an office of some sort where you're taking appointments. Maybe you establish a policy for making requests. So knowing that it often takes a good 2 days to find an interpreter. If you call an agency and put in a request, sometimes it takes at least 2 days. In some places of the country, it's going to take more than that because there are not enough sign language interpreters to go around. There's not enough captioners to go around. So you might have a policy in place that says we require, 48 hours notice. It really depends on a case-by-case basis what service that you're providing. And if you allow the hearing world or the able-bodied world to make emergency requests, then you also have to respect that when deaf people do it as well. You can't say that hearing people can make last-minute requests, but deaf people cannot because of the accommodation requirement. If hearing people are able to do it, then deaf people can do it too, and you have to have that emergency requesting strategy in place. And then also with in regard to how soon, what does the landscape of service providers in your area look like? So in Chicago, we know that there are not enough sign language interpreters to go around. So I encourage all the people that I can to make their request at least a full week out. If you make it under a week, there's no guarantee that you will get a sign language interpreter. I know that in many places of the country it's very similar. So if you start working in this area a lot, you might start to understand the lay of the land and how many service providers are out there. How quickly do you need to get that request out there in order to guarantee services? Okay. Now we'll talk about the accommodations themselves. I won't read this slide word for word, but it's basically talking about the qualifications of sign language interpreters. How do you know that somebody is qualified? And on the right, I have three pictures here. These are pictures, unfortunately, of three people acting as interpreters who were unqualified for the jobs that they were doing. The one on the top, this guy, this was in Florida for one of the hurricanes, and they decided, the news station decided they wanted a sign language interpreter in the broadcast. And so instead of calling an agency or instead of calling for a qualified interpreter, somebody said, oh, I think my cousin knows some sign language. He's a lifeguard. Let me call him and see if he's available. So this guy in a bright yellow polo shirt shows up to the news station and starts waving his hand around. He made it all the way onto Trevor Noah. So this is just to impress upon you that qualified interpreters come with credentials usually. The credentialing process is state by state, so there might be some differences if you're working in Illinois versus if you're working in New York. But again, the second picture, the woman there is also, she was a bogus interpreter who just waved her hands around in the air. And I think she was prosecuted for fraud. And then the guy in the bottom, the man on the right with his hands in the air was also a fraud. And this was Nelson Mandela's funeral. And I want to stress that unfortunately it is common that sign language interpreters, if they cannot produce credentials for you, they're usually what we refer to as a signer. So they might know some sign language, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be qualified to provide effective communication in the situation. And I caution you to be careful about using people who are signers or people who say they know a little bit of sign language as an interpreter. It might actually backfire on you, and you are not going to be able to defend yourself in court should it come up that you tried your best to provide a qualified interpreter. I do have a link here, credentialed interpreters differ state by state. You can find your state requirements here at this website. So it's rid.org, and the rest of the link is there. But RID is the Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf, and you can find your state requirements as well as a directory of interpreters working in the state who are licensed. All right, so sign language interpreters, again, here's the logo of the two hands. You can, if you just Google sign language interpreter logo, you can bring up this image. It's very easy to find. You can find them, you can find sign language interpreters through agencies. If you look online, you know, type in your city or your zip code and then sign language interpreter agency, hopefully some will show up. Or you can direct contract with an interpreter. You can find them sometimes on a state directory or again, rid.org, that directory. Does the deaf person have a preferred interpreter? Sometimes it's nice to, if they have an interpreter that they've worked with in the past who has worked well for them, they might have that request. It's not always guaranteed that you can that interpreter will be available, but it's nice to honor that request when it's made. If you have any prep material, it is, interpreters love to get that information ahead of time so that they can prepare for their job. If they can read through, if you're giving a speech or if you are teaching in a classroom and you have lecture notes that you've prepared, sometimes universities have, like what we're using today, they have Blackboard or they have Moodle or Canvas, any of those online software portals that are used with students to communicate about the classroom. Sometimes it's really nice to give the interpreter access to that as well so that the interpreter can take a look at what's going on in class and prepare in that way. Also, if there's a medical appointment going on, it's nice to give the interpreter information about what exactly is happening, what's expected to go on that day. Is it a surgical consultation? Is it a diabetes checkup? Or is it an actual procedure? Interpreters are covered under the same HIPAA laws. We're also covered under our own code of ethics, confidentiality laws and rules. So there shouldn't be any, I guess, anxiety about sharing that information with the interpreter. In some cases, it's really imperative, just kind of as an example horror story. One of my colleagues said that she was booked for an appointment where the information that she got was eye exam. That was all the information that was given because the eye doctor didn't feel comfortable providing any further information about the patient or the date, I guess, the appointment. And when she got there, it wasn't an eye exam. They were doing eye surgery and removing the eyeball, which she would not have accepted this job had she known all of the gory details. For myself, there are some times where I would faint at the sight of blood. So if I know that that a job is going to include blood, I might not take that job. And that's something that you're going to want to include when you're booking that interpreter or whatever accommodation. Let's see. Don't engage the interpreter on the job. So standard practice, when you're working with an interpreter, I wouldn't say ignore the fact that they're there, because sometimes you do need to work directly with the interpreter to make sure that communication has been effective. But don't talk to the interpreter as if they are there socially. Also, when you're talking to a deaf client, speak directly to the client. Don't use the tell him I said this or tell her I say this. It's just considered rude. It also sometimes can be confusing who you're trying to talk to. Another thing is if there are papers, if there are files that are being passed to the deaf client, resist the urge to pass them to the interpreter. I know sometimes it can get confusing because you're hearing the interpreter's voice, but I can't tell you how many doctors have tried to give me medical files of the patient when they should have been handing it directly to the patient. So, and then also the biggest no-no in working with interpreters is please do not tell the interpreter, don't interpret this, and then go on to say something that you didn't actually want the deaf person to hear. It's rude. Interpreters most of the time will continue to interpret, and so everything that you didn't want them to say just got interpreted anyway. But then also, sometimes people will think that they can turn the interpreter off and then talk in front of the deaf person as if the deaf person is not there. And again, you wouldn't do this with a hearing person. If there really is something that you need to talk to somebody about confidentially, you need to either leave the room or have the deaf person leave the room. Don't talk about them in front of them like they're not there. Okay, so strategizing how to use your sign language interpreter properly. If you are, for example, in the top image, I have a group of business people sitting in a circle. If you have a setup like this where the conversation is bouncing around the circle or a conference table and there's multiple people speaking, it's very helpful to introduce yourself every time you start talking. It may seem like it's a little excessive, but it really helps the interpreter to signal to the deaf person who's talking now, because otherwise it can get confusing on who's saying what. If an argument breaks out, who started that, who's responding. Even if it's not an argument, if it's just a regular discussion, it's very helpful to introduce your name every single time you start talking. Because the deaf person is watching the interpreter the whole time. If they look away from the interpreter to search the circle to figure out who's talking and then look back to the interpreter, they've already missed out what's being said during that time that they looked away from the interpreter. Always use the microphone. So interpreters and captioners often roll their eyes when there's a conference full of people that are supposed to be using a microphone if they want to make a comment or ask a question, and they don't want to wait for the microphone, or maybe there's a problem with the microphone, and they say, oh, I'm loud enough anyway, I'll just talk. Microphones are not just for amplification to be nice or convenient. It's actually an access issue. So if there is a microphone set up, it is there usually for access purposes. You don't know, but there may be somebody using the FM system. There might be a captioner, a remote captioner, who's depending on audio coming through that microphone in order to be able to do their job. Same thing with the sign language interpreter. You may think you're loud enough, but that might not be true. It might not be loud enough to be heard over the rustling of paper or bodies or anything else. So please get out of the habit of saying, I'm loud enough. Know that the microphone is an access issue, and just wait for it. If there's a problem with the microphone, try and troubleshoot it before just barreling on through with whatever you're doing, because the deaf person is going to be left out. Please caption your videos. Even if you have a sign language interpreter in your conference or in your classroom, it's not the same to assume that a sign language interpreter can interpret a video or a movie the whole way through. And you may think, oh, it's just a 3-minute video. But the deaf person, first of all, has to split their focus between looking at the interpreter and looking at the video. It's hard to watch both at the same time. Videos sometimes can be quite complicated and fast for an interpreter to be able to keep up with. It is much better access, it's more effective communication to caption your videos instead of depending on a sign language interpreter. And then also careful with the lighting. So this picture on the bottom here shows some kind of classroom situation. The teacher is there in the background looking at a lighted screen, like a smart screen, and the lights are off so that everyone can see their computers and the screen. This classroom is pretty dark, and if you have a long time going on with a darkened classroom like this and a sign language interpreter trying to work and the deaf person trying to depend on that interpreter for information, it's quite tiring on the eyes and the brain for that deaf person to try and figure out what the sign language interpreter is saying in the dark. So be careful with lighting. If you do turn off the lights in your conference room or your classroom to be able to see screens better, make sure that you still have enough lighting on the interpreter for the deaf person to be able to access communication. All right. The top left picture shows a typical setup in a doctor's office in a patient room. So you have the doctor who's sitting on his stool taking notes. Next to the doctor is the sign language interpreter. And then across from the interpreter and the doctor is the deaf person. For any three-person situation or more people, but generally you're going to want the interpreter to be right next to the person who is speaking the most. And the deaf person obviously will be across from the interpreter. For sight lines, for effective communication, this is going to be the best setup. I just stress this because sometimes if people are new to the process of working with interpreters, it's uncomfortable for them to have somebody standing right next to them, feeling like, you know, they're breathing over their shoulder, but this is most effective setup. And then again, if you look down, the image on the bottom left, this reiterates that same idea. This time it's at a table instead of in a doctor's office. So this is a table with four chairs. The hearing person is the blue face. The interpreter is the pink face sitting next to the hearing person, and the deaf person is across from the interpreter. The deaf person could really sit in either one of those chairs, the one on the left or the right, but again, stressing the point that the deaf person sits across from the interpreter, and the interpreter sits next to the hearing person. This is so the interpreter can hear the hearing person the whole time, but also so the deaf person can catch the hearing person's body language, facial expression, kind of within the same sight line as the interpreter. All right. So again, providing an interpreter depends what you're doing. In the top right corner, there's the podium with, I think this is Mayor Bloomberg, and an interpreter who was set next to the podium as Mayor Bloomberg talked about the Hurricane Sandy. And this was one of the first times that we saw a large-scale press conference like this include a sign language interpreter and keep the interpreter on screen throughout the press conference. Unfortunately, what happens often, even as recently as the last hurricane season or fire season in California, sign language interpreters are hired for press conferences. They're stuck next to the podium, and the guy or the person doing the filming zeroes in on the person speaking at the podium and cuts out the interpreter, which completely destroys the point of providing the interpreter in the first place. If you're going to provide an interpreter at the press conference, the goal is to include that interpreter in the broadcasted message so that deaf people watching TV or Facebook Live or however this is being broadcasted can access the sign language taking place. And then on the bottom right, we have an aerial view of a theater. The stage is at the bottom of that image, and then you have the rows of seating. This is a common placement for interpreting services. It is not the only option, but you might see this most often. The pink smiley faces are the interpreters who are placed either on or just off the stage on the floor in front of the front row and off to one side of the stage. Deaf people are then going to be seated a couple rows back, not in the first row, not right in front of the interpreter. It's too close. It's not a good sight line for them to try and look at the interpreter from 6 inches away. So the deaf people are going to be seated a couple rows back at least, and then even further off to the side a little bit so that when they look at the interpreter, they can almost look through the interpreter to the action on stage. If you have those deaf people seated in the center, and then the interpreters are off to the side, when the deaf people want to look at the interpreter, when the deaf people want to look at the interpreter, then they would have to break focus from looking at anything on the stage, look at the interpreter, and then return their eyes back to the stage. It's not good sight lines. So think of this green arrow as the sight line. When you're placing interpreters, make sure you think about that. All right. I'm going to speed through some of these slides because I see we're running lower on time, and I want to have time for question and answer. So this is a conference table setting. If you're using a screen on one side of the conference room, you might want to have your deaf person on that side of the screen, have your interpreter across from the deaf person. That interpreter could even stand on either side of the screen for best sight lines. Versus if you're not using the screen and the hearing person is leading the meeting, then you have the interpreter seated right next to them. The deaf person can be adjacent or across. All right, using deaf interpreters. Deaf interpreters are deaf language experts. Deaf interpreters typically are people who are native users of sign language. They also might have a more nuanced understanding of gesture and communication that goes beyond standard American Sign Language. So you would work with a deaf interpreter or a CDI, a certified deaf interpreter, in tandem with a hearing interpreter. So the communication goes from the deaf person to the CDI to the interpreter to the hearing person. and then back again. You would usually use deaf interpreters in press conferences, or if with people whose first language is not ASL or English, deaf people with intellectual disabilities, deaf people with CP or other mobility barriers, as language models for children with deaf-blind individuals, and again, an emergency briefing. In this picture on the bottom left, you'll see two people using pro-tactile interpreting. So you see them doing action on the forearm of this deaf-blind person. If you want to get a better take on deaf-blind interpreting, look it up on YouTube. There's some pretty spectacular videos on it, especially there's one boy, a deaf-blind boy, whose family, or I guess friends, is doing pro-tactile interpreting for him to be able to participate as a soccer game. He's watching a soccer game. All right, video relay service. Video relay service is live interpretation on a phone call. If you look at the image down below, there's a deaf person using a video screen. They can see the interpreter. The interpreter is sitting in an office in a call center anywhere in the United States. They can see the deaf person on the video screen and talk to the hearing person on a headset, so the hearing person is using a telephone. So think of VRS as telephone service if you want to call a deaf person versus VRI. Video remote interpreting is when you are in the same room as the deaf person and you want to talk to them. You have no live interpreter. You don't have an interpreter physically present. You can remote in a sign language interpreter on a video screen. So you see the medical provider here, video screen interpreter next to her, and the patient in front of them. So video remote interpreting is for needing interpreting services in the same room, not on the telephone. VRI can be used on an actual VRI machine. You can remote them in on a tablet, sometimes on any mobile device, but not a smartphone. That's too small to be to be accessible. I'm going to pretty much skip this slide if you want to review it. These are the specifications from the ADA on the requirements for using VRI. If these four bullet points are not met, VRI is not acceptable as an accommodation for effective communication. CART, Communication Access Real-Time Translation. So this is when you have a captioner, like we have today, providing live captions for your event, can be used remote. CART people are not usually as mobile as an interpreter because they come with equipment. In this image, you can see they have a machine that they're using, and it's connected to a computer. Sometimes it's connected to a projector that's going onto a screen. An interpreter is able to follow a deaf client around a room or around a building. A CART person is not able to just pick up their machine and portably move throughout a building. CART can be projected onto a large screen. You can see it in the picture on the right. They're using a large screen. Or it can be plugged into, or I guess remoted into, a smaller laptop computer, a smartphone device, a tablet. It's pretty cool what they can do with technology nowadays. Here, again, you see CART shown on a large screen. On the left, you can see, I think that's Bill Clinton, speaking, as well as the sign language interpreter is also shown on the screen with the CART captioning happening at the same time on the same screen. Sometimes you'll have it on a separate screen, as you see in the picture on the left. All right, FM loop system. For large auditorium or conference-style rooms, in more modern buildings, there's usually a loop system installed in the building. Check to see if this is actually included in wherever the space you're using. It's an induction loop that is placed along the outside of the building, or the outside of the space, of the room. And then people either already have their own device that they can turn on and access that loop system, or sometimes hearing headsets can be distributed where people can use them and access this FM loop system. If you're using the FM loop system, sometimes you have to have specialized microphones. Again, make sure that you're using those microphones. don't assume that you're loud enough. It doesn't work the same way. Open and close captions. If you are showing films in presentations, classes, cultural events, make sure you caption your videos. If you make films for businesses or organizations, caption those videos. Plays, scripted live performances can be done for free if you have enough time, but usually you're going to want to hire somebody who knows how to do this professionally, who can project those captions. And then if you don't want to caption your own videos, there are third parties out there who offer to do it for you at a cost, but they also know what they're doing. Let's see. Also, just in terms of working with deaf populations, any visual aids that you can use are always going to be a boon. So whether it's a visual chart, like we have here on showing the water cycle, or an image, especially in medical situations, it might help to show a deaf person an image of the body or a body system that you're talking about, so that you can show them directly on that image what you're talking about and whatever the issue is. Written communication. Sometimes hearing people think, oh, well, I can just write back and forth with a deaf person, but this is really for short communication needs only. Are you going to conduct their entire appointment through written communication and writing back and forth? And if you think about it, are you going to provide the same communication through writing that you would if you were able to talk to this person or use an interpreter or a captioner? Usually hearing people don't. Usually what happens with written communication is people get frustrated because it's taking too long, or we can't understand each other's writing, or this, that, and the other thing, and they shorten the communication, which makes it's not as effective. So can people read your writing? Can you read theirs? This process is slow, so think about how much time do you have. All right, so in conclusion, again, think about who your deaf client is and what are their communication preferences. Strategically plan accommodation services. Work with the accommodations provider prior to the event to make sure that you are set up properly. Effective communication is case by case. Again, what works for one person is not going to work for everyone. And you are ultimately responsible for ensuring that communication has been effective. So whichever route you take, make sure you're checking in with your deaf client to make sure that it has been effective for them. And if there are adjustments needed to be made, then you can go ahead and make them. All right. Thank you for your time. I guess we'll open it up for questions now.
All right. Thank you very much, Shannon. Michelle, if you could come in quickly and give our phone participants instructions on how they can ask questions, please.
I sure can. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press star, then the number one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press star, then one.
All right. While we're waiting for that, Shannon, there was some confusion about the application of Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act. And just for reiteration, that provision applies to healthcare providers that receive funds from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, programs that are directly administered by HHS or the health insurance markets or plans that are offered through those markets. That is who is subject to the 1557 requirements. And just to let folks know, and as you know this, Shannon, that the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, just last week published a proposed regulation that is designed to revise the implementation and enforcement of Section 1557 of the Affordable Health Care Act. You can read that proposed rule and get information on how to submit a comment on that proposed rule by visiting regulations.gov and searching for Section 1557 of the Affordable Health Care Act. But Shannon, if you could just talk about that, that in many instances you have multiple layers of laws that apply, both from the federal level of 1557, one of the titles of the ADA, Section 504, as well as state laws, correct?
Correct. So people often ask, well, which law do I follow? A lot of times you're covered by multiple laws at once, so especially for medical providers, you're covered by the ACA in those instances where you're accepting federal insurance and providing services covered by HHS. You're also covered by the ADA, depending on how you're set up, especially, again, if you're accepting insurance from federal and state dollars, if you're a private, if you're open to the public, so Title II and III could apply, as well as state laws. So in Illinois, we have state laws that are even more strict than the ADA and the Rehab Act in terms of what you're required to provide. So you might be covered by multiple laws. Which one do you use as guidance for what you're required to provide? You use the one that is actually most strict, that has the most provisions for the client. So in Illinois, for example, we would, and especially in Chicago, we would follow our local and state laws as the primary, and then, you know, with also acknowledging that we're still covered by the ADA and the Rehab Act and the ACA.
Great, Shannon. And then just real quick from the consumer side, for the patient or the individual that's deaf or hard of hearing, that provides opportunities other than, let's say, the ADA or 1557 to file complaints or exercise their rights, right?
Yes.
All right. A question here for you, Shannon. And the individual wanted some clarification that there's oftentimes a confusion when, for instance, the patient is not deaf, but there's a companion, a family member, or friend who is deaf, and what are the obligations in a medical setting, for instance, in that situation? So what are the obligations of the healthcare provider to communicate with a family member or friend who is deaf or hard of hearing?
Sure. These requirements under the ADA, the Rehab Act, the ACA, they do extend to companions. There's multiple reasons for that. One good example is that oftentimes, you know, within family networks, the person who is the patient, who is the direct patient, is hearing, but they may be getting quite a bit of assistance from their family members in terms of caregiving at home. Just even knowing what's going on with my own family members medically, they are all included in that process. If there's a deaf person who is a friend of the hearing person but is accommodating them to their medical appointment, these provisions actually do extend to them, and we are required to provide accommodations to those companions.
And you know, just from the perspective of equal access, right, Shannon? I mean, you know, the healthcare providers or even businesses in general communicate with the family or friends of the actual client. So that is going to extend, obviously, to the companions or families or family members who are deaf or hard of hearing.
Exactly.
Another question that came in early on, and this touched on you know, some of the legal requirements, but the question is, who gets to decide what effective communication is? The doctor, the patient, whose perspective trumps?
So the patient or the client, the person who is consuming those services, usually is going to be the person who is going to be able to say whether they understood or not. Did they understand the information? If they did not understand the information, then was the accommodation the problem? Now, in some instances, the accommodation itself is going to be the problem. Sometimes you have a sign language interpreter who is not a good match for the content. Maybe the sign language interpreter is great when they're interpreting theater, but they don't have medical terminology or legal. They don't know legalese. And so in those instances, they may not be qualified for that job. And the deaf person is not able to effectively communicate through that interpreter. So again, check in with the deaf person. And if you're getting the impression that maybe this deaf person is not understanding everything, again, ask them to repeat back to you what they understood so that you know, did they understand or not? Was this accommodation effective? In some cases, you might have a client who the interpreter or the captioner or whoever is the accommodations provider seems to be effective, or maybe you've even escalated this to We hired a sign language interpreter. The interpreter said we should hire a deaf interpreter. This time we hired a deaf interpreter and a sign language interpreter, and the client is still not understanding effectively. In those cases, it might be that that deaf person really should have an advocate. Do they have a social worker, whoever helps them out? Do they have family members? And is that something that they want? If you can rely on an advocate, then great. If not, you have at least tried to do your due diligence by hiring a deaf interpreter as well, and maybe it behooves you to note in your own documentation, we hired the deaf interpreter, we hired the sign language interpreter, patient still seemed confused. I'm not sure how you document that with hearing people, but whatever you might do with a hearing person who might seem confused on communication, you might want to take those same practices, take those same steps with a deaf person as well.
And Jan, someone just asked, what does CDI stand for?
CDI is Certified Deaf Interpreter. So depending on your state requirements might require that a deaf interpreter have certification or some kind of licensure, credentialing. I think that in states like New York and Florida, they are still working to get an interpreter licensure requirement on the books. In states like Illinois and I believe in Nevada, quite a few states do have interpreter licensure requirements, but then other states don't. So it's a certified deaf interpreter is what CDI stands for. Sometimes you'll see it written as DI, which means deaf interpreter. Your needs and requirements depend on your state statutes.
Great. And a question, Shannon, that we get, you know, oftentimes we'll hear from a healthcare provider. I had a request for an interpreter. I had a request for this. You know, what should I do? Can you talk about, you know, from a healthcare perspective, a healthcare provider's perspective, why it's appropriate and necessary, you know, to have a dialogue or communication with the patient before the patient shows up regarding the request.
So, again, in terms of what the deaf patient needs, do they need a sign language interpreter? Are they deafblind or deaf low vision? Do they need a deafblind interpreter or a tactile interpreter? An interpreter who does that kind of work. Do they need an interpreter who knows specialized language practices and vocabulary? So maybe they need an interpreter who specializes in medical vocabulary. They might also need, and we're getting kind of into the weeds of language here, but they might need a C sign, that's S-E-E sign language interpreter, or a PSE, a pigeon sign language interpreter, or they might need someone who does strict only ASL. And these are different systems within the sign language interpreting community that community members will know what this means and they'll recognize it. So if they do specify that with you, then when you talk to that agency, you're going to have to say they've requested a sign language interpreter who knows C-sign or signed English and go from there. So it does get slightly nuanced depending on who that person is, and that's why you want to communicate with the client before the date of service so that on that date of service things can go as smoothly as possible and you don't have to interrupt the whole situation, tell somebody, wait a minute, we have to reschedule, we have to start from scratch on accommodations, etc.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Shannon. Fortunately, we are at the bottom of the hour, so if you didn't have an opportunity to get your question answered, you know, please reach out to us, reach out to your regional ADA center, again, visiting adata.org to locate your regional ADA center. As a quick reminder, our July session will be an ADA anniversary update. We will have Andy Imperato joining us for that session on July the 16th. You can register for that session, find the information about it by visiting ada-audio.org. As a reminder, today's session is being recorded, has been recorded, and we will get an edited transcript posted to the website in approximately 3 weeks. If you have questions about the ADA audio conference program, you can give us a call at 877-232-1990. I want to thank our speaker today, Shannon Mutino, for all of her time with us for the past 90 minutes, as well as her time preparing today's session. And as always, thank you to all of you for joining us. Please encourage you to complete the session evaluation. That helps us identify topics and areas of interest that you want to hear us present as part of the ADA Audio Conference series. So once again, thank you all for joining us today. We look forward to you joining us in July. So thanks and take care. Good day, everyone.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.